In addition to MCAST, a subscription to emedhome.com includes over 1,000 video lectures from the best EM conferences, with more added all the time. View on any device whenever and wherever you want. All this and so much more, including hundreds of CME credits each year for the low cost of only $99. emedhome.com. For 20 years, the homepage of emergency medicine. Subscribe now.
Greetings and welcome to the April edition of EMED Home's EM Cast. This is Amal Mattu at the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and welcome back to the EM Cast. Well, this month we've got two topics, but a whole heck of a lot of information to cover. We're going to talk about a really important article that was published in late 2017, actually, so it's been a little bit of time. This has been on the back burner, but we finally got around to doing this topic. It's called Refusal of Emergency Medical Treatment, Case Studies and Ethical Foundations, published in Annals of Emergency Medicine by Catherine Marco. In emergency medicine, as everybody out there knows, it is so important to understand the against medical advice and refusal of care issues. This is a highly litigious type of topic. And we need to know how to do this right, because a lot of our patients do end up leaving against medical advice, and we can't force care on them, so sometimes they're going to refuse care. We've got to know how to document. We've got to know how to discuss these issues with the patient. This is a really great article. So we're going to go through that article and talk about the key points. And then secondly, we're going to spend some time talking about what is probably most of us would consider a bread and butter topic in emergency medicine, and that is the evaluation and management of acute pancreatitis. Now, I thought I knew pancreatitis inside and out. It's something that we see almost every day, and we've been seeing this for many, many years. Well, there's a nice article that was recently published in Journal of Emergency Medicine called Acute Pancreatitis Updates for Emergency Clinicians, and it went through a lot of the literature, busted some of the myths that have been taught over the years, and gosh, there's a lot that I did not know about taking care of acute pancreatitis. This is the most common GI cause of admission, and yet a lot of what we've been doing for many years is either wrong or at the very least unknown. So we're going to take that topic. It's a long topic, so we're going to split it up into two parts. We're going to kick off the EMCast by talking about, first of all, part one of pancreatitis, evaluation and management and imaging of patients with pancreatitis. Then we're going to change gears and talk about the refusal of care issues, and then we're going to come back and finish off the topic of pancreatitis by talking about management and some of the scoring systems, risk stratification, and disposition. So with that, let's go ahead and get started with the April EMED Home EMCast. Okay, well, kicking things off this month on EMCast, we're going to talk about some GI emergencies. There is a nice review article in Journal of Emergency Medicine by Anna Waller and colleagues on acute pancreatitis, updates for emergency clinicians. And pancreatitis is certainly something that I'm sure we all see on a regular basis. And we've all been taught how to treat pancreatitis, I think. But because it's so common, I kind of get the sense that maybe there's a lot of stuff that we're just doing out of historical dogma, and maybe there's some things that we're not doing right. So this article actually addressed some of those topics, and for parts of this, this might be a really nice review. Anyways, great article. And joining me to discuss this article is a new voice on EMCast, a relatively new faculty here at University of Maryland, Dr. Neerja Murli, who just joined us. Neerja, what, last year, I guess?
Yeah.
When in the past year?
About 8 months ago, something
All right.
like that.
Fantastic. So just a little background on Neerja. She trained in emergency medicine at the Michigan State Program at McLaurin Oakland Hospital in Pontiac, the final year of which she was chief resident. And then after finishing residency, she actually worked out in the community for a couple of years in Northern Virginia before deciding to come back to academics and join us. And so, Neerja, welcome to University of Maryland, and welcome to the EMCast, and hopefully we'll be hearing your voice on EMCast many future times.
Thanks for having me.
As things go along. So anyway, why don't we just go ahead and jump right into this article. We'll start out with some basics, and just to kick things off, can you tell us exactly what pancreatitis is and how it's defined?
Sure. First off, the reason that this is important, kind of some epidemiologic stuff. Pancreatitis is actually one of the more common complaints. It is the most common GI reason for admission to the hospital. And overall, it's in the top 20. I believe they said it was 20 or maybe 21st most common cause of admission. So definitely something that we're all going to see in our practice and need to know how to manage. So in terms of what is pancreatitis, the technical definition of this is essentially it is autodigestion of the pancreatic tissue by pancreatic enzymes.
So you're kind of eating your own body.
Exactly.
Okay.
Doesn't sound fun.
No.
So most of the time, this is something that will spontaneously stop. But in some patients, it won't. And that's when you start to get the symptoms. And if it gets bad enough, you can actually get tissue necrosis, hemorrhage, infection, sepsis, death. So definitely something that we need to be worried about.
Yeah. And I guess with the number of patients with pancreatitis we see in the emergency department, what I find is that I think we all get kind of cavalier about pancreatitis and don't really realize how often or the very fact that some of these patients can really, really get sick.
Yes.
And go upstairs and have terrible outcomes.
Yeah, definitely. When patients have pancreatic necrosis, there's actually quite a high mortality rate. It's about a 15% mortality rate. And this article actually mentions that if that pancreas gets infected on top of that, the mortality rate jumps to about 30%.
Wow.
So I think we forget about that. We see a lot of the mild to moderate, but it can be quite severe.
Right. And since we don't work in the ICU, or most of us listening don't work in the ICU, we kind of don't know
we
about what happens at the back end.
Yep.
Yeah. All right, great. How about etiologies? What are the typical causes of pancreatitis?
Well, I don't know if you remember that mnemonic, the I get smashed mnemonic.
I've never heard that before.
No?
No.
So this is something I remember from way back even in medical school, studying for boards. So for those who...
I get smashed.
Correct.
All right, I like that.
So for those who may have forgotten or have never heard it, so the I stands for idiopathic. G is gallstones. E is ethanol. T is trauma. S is for steroids. M is for mumps. A is for autoimmune. S is for the widespread scorpion
yes.
bite that we all see.
I was waiting for that.
H has a couple of things, hyperlipidemia, hypothermia, or even hyperparathyroidism
okay.
can be causes. E is for ERCP, and D is for drugs. So
right.
these are kind of the classes that we say is the most common. I don't know about you, but I haven't seen all that many scorpion bites personally.
No, it's been at least a week or two.
Yeah, I think maybe a little longer for me.
So,
but the three most common are going to be gallstones, which is the most common cause. Second most common being alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And third actually being triglycerides or hyperlipidemia.
So
and in actually up to about 25 to 30% of cases, there is no found proven cause for the pancreatitis. So that would be a pretty common one too.
Here in the inner city, alcohol certainly is probably the most common thing that we see, but it's always a good reminder that in the real world, I guess gallstones are still number one.
Yep, definitely.
So, all right,
and just as a point, even if somebody does drink alcohol, they could still have gallstones,
sure.
just like anything else. So something that we always need to have on our differential.
Sure. Okay. Well, I will definitely try not to forget to ask you how we'll figure that out
sure.
as we get to the exam part. I like that mnemonic. I get smashed. We'll put that in the show notes just for people that want a nice little mnemonic. So moving forward, typically we think of pancreatitis when there's upper abdominal pain and tenderness plus vomiting. Is there anything else in the history or the exam that we need to think of that would kind of tip us off, that we need to think about it and work up pancreatitis?
So I think one important thing is to always have a broad differential. Make sure you're getting a good history as you would with any patient. As you said, yes, the classic story is upper or epigastric abdominal pain with some nausea, vomiting. Oftentimes this pain will radiate to the back. One thing that I found interesting in this article that I didn't really think of, but it makes sense, is that these patients actually will have some anorexia because it's worse with oral intake. Their pain is triggered by oral intake, so you find that they don't really want to eat as much. One thing that I would urge you all to consider is make sure you have a broad differential diagnosis. If you have a patient that has pain in this epigastric area, sometimes it can be seen as chest pain, abdominal, so make sure that you are considering your maybe ACS or dissection in the right patient who has chest pain or epigastric pain radiating to the back. But that's just kind of a side note that I don't want people to get anchored on a diagnosis.
Right. And that's a really important side note. I have to admit, I learned that the hard way. Years ago when I was working at Mercy Hospital, we had a patient who was a frequent visitor and alcoholic. He came in complaining of upper abdominal pain. And he said, I think this is my pancreatitis. And he had been, admitted before for pancreatitis. So we just went right down the pancreatitis
right.
pathway. and he ended up getting labs, which were, for the most part, non-diagnostic. He actually got a CAT scan also, which was non-diagnostic, and we were going to admit him, so finally he got the admission EKG. And he had a new right bundle with an anterior STEMI that was going on. And so, you know, there was no cath lab at the time, and he had, there was a number of reasons why he really didn't qualify for lytics. You know, he got appropriate treatment. He ended up doing okay. But when I went back after looking at the EKG and said, you know, got a little bit more history, I discovered that this was different than his normal pancreatitis in that he said, no, this time my pancreatitis is not radiating to my back. And this time my pancreatitis is making me really sweaty. And so I really didn't hammer down on that history to figure out, is this really exactly like your normal pancreatitis? And so it was a learning point to think of a broad differential. And also upper abdominal pain is not necessarily an abdominal problem. It can be a thoracic problem as well.
Exactly. And so, I think it's easy to anchor, especially if you have the history.
Yeah.
But making sure you get a good, relevant history to today's complaint is definitely important. So moving back to pancreatitis, some of the things that we may see on exam, of course, they're going to have that epigastric tenderness to palpation, maybe some right upper quadrant tenderness as well. This is one of those cases where I think it's really important that we undress our patient. Of course, we want all of our patients undressed, but in late stage pancreatitis, you can see things like your Cullen sign and your Gray Turner sign. For those of you who may not remember what those are, the discoloration around the umbilicus is Cullen sign, or flank discoloration is called Gray-Turner sign, and this is due to retroperitoneal hemorrhage. So with all patients, we should really be undressing and inspecting before we do anything, but these are definitely findings we don't want to miss. Not something you're going to see very often. These are very late-stage findings. They're rare, less than 1% of patients.
Except on the boards.
Except on the boards or at ABEM General.
Right.
So we want to make sure not to miss them.
Right. So don't do the abdominal exam through the ski jacket.
Exactly.
Parker, right. All right.
Another thing that you don't want to miss is abnormal vital signs. Of course, with any patient, but make sure you look at these vitals. One study that this article reviewed actually found that there were up to 41% of patients who were admitted for pancreatitis had a 2 out of 4 SIRS criteria. So make sure that you are looking at your vitals, and when you order those labs, that you're looking for all abnormals, not just that lipase.
Sure. Okay.
And back to the history, other risk factors that maybe we wouldn't consider. Of course, we're going to ask about alcohol use or history of gallstones if we suspect pancreatitis, but ask them about their medications. I'm not going to go through the whole list of medications, but there's bunches of different medications that can cause this. Specifically, antiretrovirals are a big cause for those patients who have HIV, which we definitely see a lot of here in Baltimore. And asking about family history is important as well, because there are some studies that show that there may be a genetic component to this as well. Mm-hmm. But, you know, just like any patient, making sure you're being thorough is always going to be key.
Okay. Now, you mentioned and let me go back to what I had alluded to earlier, so I don't forget. You mentioned right upper quadrant tenderness. Now, I guess most patients with routine run-of-the-mill pancreatitis have epigastric pain. And maybe left upper quadrant pain. If they have right upper quadrant pain also, is that when you start worrying about gallstone-related pancreatitis?
That's when I would start worrying about those things. And we'll talk about imaging and, you know, things to look for here. Definitely gallstone pancreatitis is a very common thing that we see.
Right.
So looking based on the physical, and also, of course, looking for some of those stigmata, I guess you would call them, jaundice, scleral icterus, the other things that you would see if you have biliary tract disease could definitely point you towards those right upper quadrant diagnoses as well.
Okay. Well, that's leading us right into how we diagnose these patients. So why don't we get into that? So, okay, so obviously history and physical is the key. Beyond the history and physical, where do we go next? Let's say you're starting, based on your history and physical, it's in your differential, you're starting to think about it. Where do we go now?
I think here we need to make a little bit of a distinction between acute and chronic pancreatitis. Obviously, we're going to focus on acute since that's what this article is discussing. And most of the stuff I'm going to say here is specific to that, because when we're looking at labs and stuff like that, we're thinking about acute pancreatitis. But we'll definitely need to at least touch on the fact of chronic as well.
Okay.
If we go by this article, there's a couple of labs that I thought were interesting that maybe I'm curious to hear your thoughts on. What they recommend is your CBC, your metabolic panel, your liver enzymes, and then they actually recommend getting triglycerides and LDH level. Now, if we talk about Ranson's criteria and all of those scoring criteria, definitely something that's on there. But I know when I'm thinking about abdominal pain, maybe triglycerides and LDH aren't on the top of my list of things to order. Maybe they should be, but, you know, I know that many of us, as part of our initial standard labs, may not be getting these.
Yeah, I don't even, I mean, LDH oftentimes comes back with some of the comprehensive metabolic panels.
Yeah.
And I know we can get that back relatively quick. I don't even know about triglycerides. I don't know if it's a quick turnaround, and even if it is, I'm not sure I really ever pay attention to it.
Well, and I think that depends on your practice setting.
Yeah.
Somewhere academic, you may be able to get that because a send-out lab would be coming to you anyways. But if you're in a critical access or, you know, rural hospital, you may not have access to that
right.
lab.
Was that something that you recall being able to get back in Northern Virginia at the community site?
You know, I have to be honest, I don't think that there was ever a time that I ordered it.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Because if I'm thinking triglycerides, the patient's going to get admitted anyways.
Right. Right.
So getting right. ahead of myself here.
Okay.
Of course, we want to get our lipase, which is kind of our standard serum marker that we use in the emergency department to help us diagnose acute pancreatitis. The classic diagnostic criteria for pancreatitis is a lipase that is 3 times the upper limit of normal. Having said that, I have seen, and I'm sure you have seen, patients who are not even close to 3 times the upper limit who definitely have symptoms suggestive of pancreatitis. Mm-hmm. That's one thing to consider, that the labs are not a hard and fast cutoff. And the other thing is lipase can be elevated in other conditions as well. Pancreatitis is not the only thing that's going to affect your lipase. There was mention of a Cochrane review in this article that actually mentioned other GI conditions, specifically inflammatory bowel disease, as a condition that can elevate lipase.
Okay.
So don't just base it solely on your labs.
Now, what about amylase? It's almost like one phrase, amylase lipase. As opposed to ordering them separately. Do you routinely check amylase with the lipase?
You know, I think that's interesting because I remember reading that in board review books and things like that when I was a resident, but I don't remember ever really ordering that lab. And maybe that's local practice where I trained, or I'm not sure if kind of the standards have changed. But for me personally, again, I can't remember the last time I used an amylase as a marker for pancreatitis. The reason for that being is it's less sensitive, it's less specific. It's secreted by multiple different organ tissues, salivary glands being one that we all know, but also small intestines, adipose tissue, and several other things can release amylase as well. So having an elevation of amylase isn't necessarily a marker. I kind of liken it to using a CKMB to assess for ACS rather than a troponin.
Right.
I think that's a good analogy.
Yeah. I think over the years, the literature that we've seen also has shown that it's less specific and also less sensitive than lipase.
Yes,
so,
if I didn't mention that. Yeah, definitely.
I don't know how much money you save by skipping the amylase, but it's probably not going to add anything.
I don't think so.
Okay.
And then another test that this article mentions that I didn't even know existed is a trypsinogen level, which I think would definitely be a send out at most places. But the short story for those who are interested in the academic aspect of it is this is the enzyme that's cleaved to kind of initiate that reaction of the auto ingestion. So
the trypsinogen level, of course.
Right.
So definitely another test that I have never ordered. I'm not sure what the turnaround for that would be.
And I don't think ABEM General would ask you about that either.
Right.
Those are the labs that we use. And one thing that I didn't actually knew this had a name, but there's something called the Atlanta criteria, which can be used to help diagnose acute pancreatitis. And having 2 out of the 3 is considered to be diagnostic. The 3 criteria are clinical, which is upper abdominal pain, elevation of amylase and lipase and or lipase, and imaging findings of pancreatic inflammation.
Okay, so number 1, clinical findings of upper abdominal pain, number 2, elevated lipase, and then number 3, positive imaging.
Correct.
And you have to have 2 out of the 3?
Yes.
Okay.
And so I think that's a good segue for us to talk about some of this imaging.
Sure.
Well, I guess, let me ask you, is imaging part of your initial workup when you're suspecting pancreatitis?
Yeah, you know, that's a source of controversy and what I'm hoping to have you answer definitively. So it certainly seems like a lot of the admitting folks always, or traditionally have always wanted to get a CAT scan. And we've even had the GI people come and talk to us at conference before and say, you definitely don't need a CAT scan. In fact, it's probably better to not even do a CAT scan on the first day. It might be something to do on the second or third day for various reasons that I don't remember. So
I'm going to tell you.
We've gradually pushed against the routine CAT scan. I think we would probably get imaging if the diagnosis is uncertain. What does the literature say about
that? Well, and I agree with you. My practice and my training has never said CT as first line in diagnosing acute pancreatitis. And maybe that's based on these Atlantic criteria that I, you know, didn't know had an official name. So I actually, the point that your GI doctor made is very good. Oftentimes in pancreatitis, if you get a CT too early, you may have a negative CT. And so it may be beneficial to wait till 48 or even 72 hours out to obtain that CT if that's the diagnosis of suspicion. Now, if you do get that CT and it is positive, there's a few different things that you might see. In addition to inflammatory changes around the pancreas itself or within the pancreas, you may see a fluid collection, a pseudocyst, any signs of necrosis, pleural effusions, which can be a bad prognostic indicator, and any signs of any organ infarct may show up on your CT as well. But it's almost like getting a chest x-ray for pneumonia. If you get it the minute your symptoms start, you may not see those.
Sure.
So I think you have to use your clinical judgment to decide when to obtain this CT.
What about ultrasound? Is that a suitable substitute?
Now, that depends whether we're talking about an ultrasound of the pancreas itself or of the right upper quadrant, as we had alluded to before.
Sure.
So the data shows that ultrasound of the pancreas is often inadequate. Many times it's a poor quality study, and you don't really see anything on the ultrasound of the pancreas. What they do recommend is if you have no obvious cause for your symptoms, that we get a right upper quadrant ultrasound in those patients who may have a first episode or, again, no, you know, history or risk factors to suggest something else. The reason for that being, in addition to looking for cholecystitis, there are other things that may show up on ultrasound, ascending cholangitis or choledochalithiasis in the right clinical context. Definitely something we want to know whether there are gallstones present. And with cholangitis, is this something we need to be treating with antibiotics?
Sure.
If you do find stones, this is probably a patient that's going to need an ERCP. And so this is definitely something we should be considering in the ER because we want to get those consultants involved early if need be.
Okay.
Now, let's say our CT is negative. Let's say our right upper quadrant ultrasound is negative, but our patient is still having pain, having elevation of our lipase. We plan to admit this patient. One thing that this article suggests is that MR imaging is actually superior to both CT and ultrasound in diagnosing acute pancreatitis because you can differentiate soft tissue pathology as well as the biliary and pancreatic ductal structures. I don't think I have ever ordered an abdominal MR from the ED, but if your facility has MR and even MRCP, definitely something that could be considered as an inpatient.
Yeah, I'm sure that would be associated with a fairly prolonged emergency department stay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Definitely something our admins don't tend to like.
Yeah.
You don't want to do an ERCP if you're not certain of the diagnosis, so the MRCP could give you some diagnostic information that could lead to further intervention.
Sure.
One other thing that they talked about is EUS, endoscopic ultrasound. Again, something that I'm not really that familiar with, not something that we order from the ER. If you're unclear of your diagnosis, maybe something where you want to get GI involved so that they can evaluate your patient to see if they would gain any useful information through this test.
Okay, so that largely is a discussion of acute pancreatitis. You mentioned earlier chronic pancreatitis. Is that going to be any different in terms of your workup?
Yes and no. So first of all, I don't know how you learned chronic pancreatitis, but I remember the phrase burnt out pancreas.
Right.
Yep. Do you remember that?
Yeah, we've all heard that phrase. And
do you know what it means?
burnt out pancreas, in other words, the pancreas has used up all of its enzymes, and so you're not going to – essentially, the only time I would hear that phrase is when you're trying to say, this person has pancreatitis,
yeah,
but their amylase and lipase are normal because their pancreas is, quote, burnt out.
Yeah, and so when I'm preparing for this discussion, I kind of wanted to look into that to see actually what does burnt out mean.
Mm-hmm.
So first of all, whereas acute pancreatitis has – inflammatory response to injury that's usually reversible. In chronic pancreatitis, you have progressive inflammatory changes that lead to structural damage to the cells, both the endocrine and exocrine cells. And I think that is where the term burnt out comes from, because the cells that are creating these enzymes are not all functional.
Okay.
So I think that is important to know. And additionally, chronic pancreatitis is actually focal in nature. It's patchy. And so you will have a minimal increase of enzymes because it really depends which area of the pancreas is involved. There's often also fibrosis of the pancreatic tissue, and that also leads to the enzymes not being produced in the volume we would expect. So all of these things, I think, lead to the term burnt out that we've all been taught.
Great. I've never heard that before.
Yeah. So fun fact of the day.
Okay.
There'll be a test later.
Okay.
So when we're talking about chronic pancreatitis, as we've kind of alluded to, you don't see those elevations of your enzymes. So how do we make this diagnosis? So I think this is where there's an interesting discussion to be had. And you and I were briefly discussing this earlier when we were preparing for this about whether we need to get imaging on all patients.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have a chronic pancreatitis, one thing that you will see is you'll see calcifications on CT oftentimes. You may also see ductal dilatation or pseudocysts, as well as an enlarged pancreas. These are all CT findings we may see. Now, CT is about 75 to 90% sensitive and 85% specific. So that's fairly good.
Mm-hmm.
But that raises the question of whether every patient with chronic pancreatitis should get imaging, specifically CT imaging, every time they come to the ED. If we go by the Atlanta criteria, we need two of those three. We know that our lipase is not going to be elevated.
Right.
But in my opinion, if you have the clinical symptoms, you have the history, and again, getting a good history of this is exactly like my previous abdominal pain, I've had pancreatitis in the past, I think it's important to distinguish that from a ACS mimic like you had mentioned before.
Right.
But I think it's reasonable to defer CT imaging in the appropriate patient population.
Sure.
What are your thoughts on that?
No, I think that makes sense.
Yeah.
It's very usable.
A little bit more about chronic pancreatitis. These patients will actually have pancreatic insufficiency and protein and fat malabsorption issues. So in patients who have had an advanced chronic pancreatitis, some of the additional HPI things that you might consider are steatorrhea. And if they have a history of glucose intolerance or diabetes, this may be indicative of chronic pancreatitis. Their cells can't produce the insulin or the other glucose-regulating medication. So a pancreatitis patient who also has a history of diabetes should increase your suspicion for a chronic pancreatitis.
Great point.
There is a classic triad of chronic pancreatitis, which are pancreatic calcifications on imaging, steatorrhea, and diabetes mellitus. But again, this is something we only see in late disease with these malabsorption issues.
Mm-hmm.
So not all patients are going to have these. In fact, few are going to have all three.
Okay.
So, and another thing with chronic pancreatitis is making sure that you have a broad differential, even if the patient has the right story. There's actually an increased risk of pancreatic cancer in patients with chronic pancreatitis. So that should always be on your differential. Autoimmune and things like endocrine tumors can cause similar symptoms as well. Again, probably not something we think of as our first line, but I think it just kind of speaks to the importance of always having a broad differential.
Sure.
And, you know, talking about the other imaging, again, MRCP is still going to be the test of choice if available to you, or ERCP, if they don't have any calcifications, can be considered. But this is actually falling out of favor unless the patient actually needs an acute intervention.
All right, folks, we're going to take a break from pancreatitis. We're going to change gears and talk about refusal of care. And then at the end, we're going to return to finish up this article on pancreatitis with management, as well as risk stratification and disposition of these patients.
All right. Well, next up on the EM cast, we're going to spend some time talking about an article that was published actually a year ago now. I can't believe it's been on our to-do list for this long, but article that was published in Annals of Emergency Medicine on refusal of emergency medical treatment, case studies and ethical foundations. That's the title. And this was put out by the ACEP Ethics Committee. Lead author there was Catherine Marco. And it's a very nice article that goes through a number of different issues that I think we all need to take into account when we have that incredibly rare opportunity or occasion, I'm being sarcastic, of having a patient leave against medical advice. And joining me to go through this article is Dr. Dan Gingold. Dan's been on the EM cast before. He's one of our faculty that works at one of our affiliate hospitals, Bon Secours Hospital, just down the road. Dan, welcome back to the EM cast.
Thanks for having me.
It's been a while.
It has been a while.
So let me just start out. The paper starts out with four case studies, and just as, I guess, examples of the type of scenarios that we all deal with on a regular basis, just to kind of get people thinking about these issues. Case number one is a 24-year-old guy who comes in for a psychiatric evaluation. I guess he was causing some problems and hearing voices, and his mother called 911 on arrival. He's now saying, let me go. I know my rights. I want to get out of here. Case number two is also not an uncommon scenario. 25-year-old woman comes in with a forehead laceration, and she's intoxicated, and she wants to leave. Case number three is an out-of-hospital refusal of treatment. So the case that they present here is a 50-year-old who's got diabetes and altered, and his glucose was 35. They give the patient some dextrose, and then he wakes up, and he's alert, and now refusing transportation. And then case number four is a 45-year-old guy who comes in feeling sick. He's got a history of end-stage renal disease. He's been missing dialysis for a week. Sounds like half our patients. Mm-hmm. And he's got a potassium of 7.4, and his BUN is 88. And he's got pulmonary edema on x-ray. So a handful of medical issues, all of which results in him saying, well, I feel fine. Let me go home. And so those are, again, not uncommon scenarios that we all have to take care of and deal with. And Dan, you're going to give us the answers for everything.
Oh, how good. Okay. I'll solve this problem.
All right.
Once and for all.
Well, just as a little background, can you tell us why we even need to know about this and discuss this topic?
Sure. I mean, obviously, the main reason is because it's very common. This kind of thing comes up all the time, and particularly in urban environments, but I think it affects EDs all across the country. The paper mentions that about 1 to 3 ED visits leave AMA, so about 500,000 visits nationally, and even more common in urban areas like where we work. And this, you might think that, well, no big deal, this is just patients I don't have to deal with. But we've been told by payers and, you know, our administrators that that's a key metric, actually, for many emergency departments, number of AMAs or left without being seen. So that's one reason to care. But the other reason to care, and the reason why that's an important metric, is because there is some evidence that these patients are actually do worse than patients that don't leave AMA. So it's not just that people who leave AMA don't have anything wrong with them and never come back. They actually may have higher numbers of repeat ED admissions, admission and mortality rates from a couple sort of observational studies compared to patients who don't do that. So that means that, you know, it's possible that by avoiding the AMA situation, or we may reduce those outcomes, or at least that the fact that someone wants to leave AMA is not protective of their outcome. So we need to, it should actually be a red flag for, you know, paying a little bit more attention to them. And they mention a few groups of people who are more likely to do this. So people who are young, who are male, and who use alcohol and drugs, and have no insurance or Medicaid insurance are all more likely to leave AMA. One study from Vancouver actually mentioned that patients are more likely to leave AMA on welfare check day, which is interesting.
Oh, that is interesting.
Yeah, it seemed like that was a sort of urban legend, at least among the staff in the ED, that that makes a big difference. But they actually did find an association in this one study in Vancouver.
They didn't talk about full moons or anything like that.
No, no, Friday the 13th, so they didn't mention any of that.
Because that is true.
Right, exactly.
All right.
And the other just final issue, or why we need to think about it, is because when you're, it's a difficult decision because it's going to force us to act. So if someone wants to leave before we think we should leave, that presents us with the choice of do we make them stay or not. And that obviously has implications for our relationship with the patient and safety to the staff and disruption to the department and whether we're willing to do that or not. So having a way to just sort of think through specifically which situations would we choose to do that and which we would not is important to do.
Yeah. These are tough patients. I mean, as you're alluding to, they do take up a lot of staff resources and emotional resources. And, so, you know, one really, really difficult patient can practically shut down the emergency department for an hour or so. All right. Well, the article talks about some definitions. So let's just get some of those basics out of the way in terms of left without being seen, which a lot of people use that term synonymously with against medical advice. And they're not exactly the same.
No.
And then they talk about decisional capacity. So, and that's an important term. So can you take us through those terms?
Right. So left without being seen is the patients who never got to see a provider. So, and they probably never got to get a medical screening exam. So those are patients who checked into the ED, didn't want to wait to see a provider, did not get screened, and left prior to either any sort of evaluation or discussion of recommendations for treatment or evaluation. Then they mentioned this left without being discharged. We kind of call that eloped. I think that'll be sort of place to place what that's called. Usually those people have received a screening exam, started some process, and then decided to leave before their full evaluation or treatment was complete, but did not have a discussion with the provider about the specific recommendations. And so that is a little different from against medical advice, where the provider is going to make a specific determination after discussing with the patient that the patient is leaving against a recommendation from the provider. Mm-hmm. And so that really requires an evaluation, a plan of care, and then the patient sort of expressing that they don't want to do that plan of care, and you informing them that them leaving would be against your advice. And that's how we sort of designate them. Capacity is a bit more vague. I think it's sort of like, you know, obscenity, that you know it when you see it, but it's hard to write down exactly what it is.
Sure.
And first, we want to distinguish that from competence. Those words are often used interchangeably, but competence has a specific legal meaning and is determined by a court. And capacity is a clinical observation. So capacity is the person's sort of ability to understand, apply, process, and express information. So the article kind of defines it that way. So the person has to be able to understand information that you gave them. Often, you know, that they communicate that by being able to repeat it back or just understand it. Then they have to be able to appreciate how to apply that information to their own situation and goes through some sort of reasoning to make a quote unquote appropriate decision. Now, what appropriate means, especially when we're disagreeing with them, may be a little problematic.
Yeah.
And then they need to be able to express their choice. So if they're not able to do any of those things, then you would say capacity, that they don't have decision-making capacity, and therefore somebody needs to make decisions for them.
Well, I suppose we need to figure out if a patient has decisional capacity before the patient can be discharged, AMA. So how then do you figure out if the patient has decisional capacity, that ability to apply a process and understand and express the information?
Yeah, I think practically, often it's a sort of clinical gestalt sort of feeling when you're talking to them. Hopefully you get an opportunity to have this sort of reasonable discussion with them about the risk and benefits of leaving and what your recommendation is. And during that sort of probing of maybe why they'd want to leave or how they understand what's going on, you would sort of be able to ask questions to elicit that understanding and reason. But sometimes you're put in a situation where you haven't been able to have that specific discussion, but you can often tell that someone has capacity by your initial HPI and, you know, document that. And
sure.
Usually that should be sufficient. The article does mention a few official scoring tools that could be used. I'm frankly a little skeptical about their utility or practicality in the emergency department. The mini mental status exam is not meant to assess capacity. It's a cognitive test sort of for dementia. Mm-hmm. And I guess if someone did poorly on that, you might think that they're not able to do those things that we talked about capacity, but it's not really what the test was meant for. A few of these other competency assessments are quite lengthy, taking 15 to 20 minutes, even longer, and are things that emergency physicians don't do very often and don't necessarily have the training to unless you've had a lot of experience with that particular tool. They're like a structured interview or a semi-structured interview. And while that would be nice and it would be great, I think that's the type of thing that a psychiatric consult would do if mm-hmm. you're really on the fence and you have that resource available to you to have, you know, a social worker or, you know, a psychiatrist see the patient to help determine capacity. And many places that is what you might do, especially in a, you know, difficult medical case, mm-hmm. Or some underlying cognitive difficulties and things like that. That's kind of things that they would do. I think it's a bit difficult to expect emergency physicians to do that. And I certainly don't think that it would be necessarily standard of emergency care to have to document one of those things to determine if someone has capacity before they leave AMA. But you certainly would want to demonstrate somehow that you got a feel for what their decision-making capacity was at the time.
Now, you alluded to earlier that if a patient doesn't have capacity, then there has to be somebody else who makes those decisions for them.
Right.
Who is that? Who makes the decisions for the patient if the patient lacks decisional capacity? Is it totally up to us?
Not totally. It depends a little bit on the context. So there certainly are situations where it will be totally up to us, especially in a, you know, an emergent medical situation where there is no time or ability to seek out a surrogate decision maker and the patient is incapacitated due to their medical condition or intoxication or anything like that, then we do have to make decisions on behalf of the patient and try to do what's reasonable, what would be sort of a reasonable person would think is in the patient's best interest. And we are comfortable with that and do that, you know, fairly often. But that's probably a minority of the cases, especially with regard to AMA situations. So if someone does not have capacity, we need to find a surrogate decision maker for them. And each state and jurisdiction will have a slightly different hierarchical list of who that should be by default. The article mentions that in New York, and I think this is pretty common, so similar to what it is in Maryland. The hierarchy sort of goes, you know, a court-ordered appointed guardian or decision maker, medical proxy, that person would be the sort of priority or primary person. Mm-hmm. And then it would be a spouse, and then an adult child, and then a parent, and then a sibling, or then, you know, then you kind of get whoever else comes out of the woodwork. Even close friends, can sort of testify, not legally testify, but say that they have discussed with the patient. They're sort of the closest person to the patient if those people aren't available and make decisions for them.
Sure.
So it's always nice if we have someone who knows the patients and understands their wishes, especially to determine medical care, about what they might want if their decision-making capacity is impaired. So if we can get contact with those people, then that's ideal. And we would have them make the decisions for the patient.
All right, sounds good. Now, the article has a brief discussion on some of the medical legal considerations. You touched on that earlier, but can you take us through a little bit more detail about the med-mal or medical legal issues?
Sure. So a lot of the medical legal aspects of this have to do with the fact that most of our interactions with patients are governed by a need to obtain consent before we do stuff to people. And that seems like a reasonable rule that we should, in general, be asking people, is it okay when we do stuff to their bodies? And the conditions where we assume consent for people or sort of make decisions on what to do to their bodies on behalf of them are actually pretty narrow. But obviously this does happen fairly often where the patient is declining treatment that we recommend. So a few things that we need to make sure that we do if we're going to allow them to do that is that understand patients do have a duty or do have an ability to decline any treatment they want if they have decision-making capacity, even if it's life-sustaining, you know, PCI for MI, intubation, blood transfusion. Patients can decline those things. But we have a duty to inform them the consequences of doing so. So if they say, oh, I don't want the blood, and you need to say, but you are hemorrhaging to death, and without that, you will die. And if they say, I still don't want the blood, then you can't get the blood right now. The article mentions that there is risks to forcing people to do things kind of from a legal standpoint, but it is probably more common to be held liable or sued for not doing something and something bad happens to the patient. Mm-hmm. So this sort of thing we're always scared of, you know, drunk, intoxicated patients come in and we're always worried that they might go out and get hit by a car. So we want to keep them there for their safety. And certainly there are cases where that has happened. The article does mention a few cases that were recent in New York where emergency physicians were actually found not liable at the end of the trial for a similar situation, and that the patient leaving sort of ended the physician's duty to continue treating the patient. But that was a situation where the patient showed up voluntarily. You know, they weren't brought in swinging with police, mm-hmm. or, you know, for acting crazy or anything like that. And, you know, it doesn't necessarily apply other places. So it's going to be sort of up in the air whether or not you'd be held liable. So I think the basic rule that I've tried to do for this sort of difficult situations is to say, well, you can be sued no matter what you do. Anyone can sue you for any crazy thing. But you have to go to sleep at night. So you need to figure out what is in the best interest of the patient and then write it down why you thought that was in the best interest of the patient. And in my view, that has to be defensible, at least to yourself.
Sure. Okay.
So, but there are some requirements about what you're going to need to say. So you're going to need to you know, indicate that they do have capacity, that you let them know that something bad might happen to if they left, and then, you know, document their understanding of that and that you invited them to come back. Yeah, I think the other thing you have to consider is what is the alternative plan of action. So if you want them to stay and they don't want to stay, they say, I'm leaving, the alternative is to, you know, put them down and restrain them, otherwise known as battery and kidnapping. So my...
or false imprisonment.
Right. So my... I'm willing to kidnap people if I really think it's going to help them, or I'm really worried about them. But I have to be quite worried in order to do that to them. Or be very convinced that they, you know, really can't make this decision for themselves, and that the decision that they make is likely to, or possibly going to harm them. And I think without that sort of strong feeling to that, I typically do not like to take that other view, plan of action.
All right. So, and that kind of led me into the next question, which you've answered a little bit, but when you do have a disagreement about the recommended course of action for a patient who does have capacity, mm-hmm. what should we do? How do we proceed with those patients?
Right. Okay. So we're talking about a patient with capacity. So if you've done something and you determine they don't have capacity, then we're done. We can't even, right. We're going to do things
we're
to
keep
that patient
them.
What we right. want. Right. But we're assuming they have capacity. The article goes through some tools and techniques to sort of negotiate the situation, which I do think are helpful because, you know, I think what we want to avoid is battery and kidnapping as much as we can.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. And we also would like to avoid them leaving against medical advice because we think that's harmful. So what we need to do is to engage some of these communication techniques, which are sort of similar to the ones that we talked about when we talked about shared decision making, you know, allying with the patient and sort of investigating why they don't, first, maybe just trying to figure out, well, why don't they want to stay? You know, my patients might have had unpleasant experiences with the healthcare system. They might have to go feed their cat. You know, they might be worried about something. And sometimes you can actually solve the problem. You know, if they were just like, I want to leave, and you're like, okay. But you didn't investigate why that was. And the reason was, oh, they had to go pick up their kid from school. And you can say, well, could we call someone for you and work on that and help solve the problem? Then maybe they would stay. And so you don't really know their motivations until you ask. And I think asking those questions also gets a little bit to your capacity evaluation, too. I mean, you know, if what they are saying does not make sense at all, like they have to go home and protect their house from the aliens that are coming in the spaceship, that might give you a red flag for, like, hey, well, maybe, like, we shouldn't be allowing that person to make decisions for themselves. So you can investigate why they don't want to do it. You can try to mitigate those things, you know, either reassure them or try to come up with solutions to their problem. And then if they're still persistent about wanting to leave, then you need to explain why you think that it's best that they stay and what you think might happen and what you're worried about if they leave. And this should not be coercive or threatening, or, you know, people kind of try these scare tactics sometimes. And I try to be just honest and indicate that I have their interest at heart. And I often will say, I will let you leave. You know, if I'm in a situation where I'm not going to kidnap them, I say, I don't kidnap people. You can leave if you want, but let me explain why I don't think that's a good idea. And I think going that way, as opposed to, I'm not letting you leave. Mm. And then they want to leave. Now it's a fight, you know, saying, like, I'm just here to help you. Here's how I recommend is the best. You know, this is the help I'd want to give you. People are often very responsive to that. Right. And if they're not, you've at least clearly communicated what you actually want to say. And then you can just write down what you said in terms of documenting. And I think if you document that you did all of those things, it has to be defensible.
Yeah. And then when you send them, there's oftentimes been a myth or at least a practice in prior years where people would feel, well, if you're going to leave AMA, then I'm not going to give you any prescriptions, right.
It's all or nothing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they recommend strongly against that. And I do too. Remember, this is an at-risk population of patients that's leaving. So just because they're leaving does not mean that there's nothing wrong with them. In fact, it make it more likely there's something wrong with them. And so if we take our ego out of it, not be offended that they don't want our help, we should try to give the patient optimal care, even if they put restrictions on those things. So if the patient doesn't want to get admitted for IV antibiotics, they should get sent home with PO antibiotics. In fact, they might be very eager and willing to do that for their care, even if there's some reason why they don't want to be admitted. So these patients should have very clear discharge instructions. You should probably be spending more time, if it's available, on the discharge of this patient than one that you're just going to discharge anyway.
Right.
Because they're higher risk, both from a legal and a medical perspective, and we should be giving them very clear, especially return precautions. We should be encouraging them that they can come back whenever they want to this or any other emergency department. You know, if they want to, we should work to obtain them follow-up and give them any medications they might need. I mean, do the same things that you would do for anyone that you would discharge, but maybe even a little bit extra because you're worried about them.
Right.
Because if you were, you know, considering that if they couldn't make this decision for themselves, you might keep them,
sure.
Which I think is when you would label someone AMA, then you should do as much as you can for them to get good care.
Okay.
And you know, you should not be, like, about the coercion. You know, they mentioned this myth that people often tell the patients that, oh, you're going to have to cover your whole bill because the insurance company won't pay for your visit if you leave MA. That is not true at all.
Urban legend.
Yeah, total urban legend. So we shouldn't say that.
Sure. The authors also talk about some essential elements to document.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a lot of it is what you've just communicated, but do you have a little list of things that you want to make sure are on the chart?
Right. So the fact that they have decision-making capacity, what information you gave them about what you wanted to do, what information you gave them about the alternative plan that you've come up with. I think having the fact that you have bothered to come up with an alternative plan is a great thing to document. And then document that the patient understood the risks, you know, what risks you communicated to them, and that the patient understood the risks and is making a voluntary decision to go home. And then what you did. So describe your alternative plan, describe that you gave discharge instructions and follow-up and an invitation to return for care at any time. That sounds like a lot, but dot phrases are huge here. And, you know, most emergency departments now, I think, are coming up with, we have a departmental phrase that I've sort of, you know, everyone can personalize it a little bit, make it your own in language that you're comfortable with. And so that can serve for not just effective documentation, that you're making sure you're hitting all the spots so if something does happen bad to the patient, it shows that you've done the best you can for them. But it also is a good little checklist just to make sure that, oh yeah, I did all those things, or, oh, I didn't, like, I forgot to do this or make the follow-up or something, and it can kind of help you out there also just make sure that everything got done.
Yeah, and a lot of those pre-printed T-sheets or other type of paper sheets have all of that stuff listed there. So those make it a lot easier to remember to incorporate all of those essential elements as well.
Yeah.
All right. So, Dan, any final comments about the whole AMA process?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, we didn't talk about just what documentation, the AMA form. And that is a little controversial. I've heard national speakers on the topic speak passionately for and against that, and they're all experts. So I guess that means that you should just do what you want. I think there's reasons why AMA form might be helpful. It sort of shows that you went through this with the patient. It's a documentation of your conversation. It's a nice little checklist. That's nice. Hasn't been shown to be particularly legally protective, especially compared to probably what is going to be more complete and descriptive documentation that you could write yourself, and doesn't say anything about capacity, of course, which is maybe the most important part about your documentation in this circumstance. I find this sometimes, but not all the time, that they can introduce a sort of antagonistic relationship between the patient and the physician. I don't think that necessarily has to be true, depending on how the conversation goes. But some people don't like it for that reason. So I think, you know, AMA forms, do what you want, you know. In my practice, I don't make everyone sign them, but if there's a circumstance where I really think that they should do something and there's sort of no clinical equipoise at all and that there's only one reasonable plan of care, then I often will ask them to sign it after I've had the discussion with them.
Yeah, and it probably is worth checking your hospital policy.
Yes.
Because a lot of EDs have formal policies, and if there's nothing in there about the form, then so be it. But if in the formal policy it requires you to have a form, then you don't want to violate policy.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a good general rule of thumb when it comes to these issues anyway. We should be being consistent across providers in your department about how we treat this issue. You know, you don't want to be the outlier of someone who does something weird. I guess if everyone's doing a bad job, then you can be an outlier. But you don't, but yeah, if there's some, you know, departmental dot phrase, use the departmental dot phrase. You know, if there's a departmental form or in a policy, use the departmental form. I think that sort of thing is very protective. That, like, if something bad happens and someone says, oh, you should have done this, you can say, well, this is how we've decided to do it here, and I was following the policy.
Right.
I get the whole department in trouble, but at least you're all going down together.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Dan, that was a great review of this article. It's a very important article. And again, another one of those articles that oftentimes this type of article seems to show up on the LLSA readings at some point. So now all the listeners know the scoop. All right, Dan. Well, thanks so much. And look forward to getting you back for some more EM casts.
Yeah. Great.
All right. Thanks, Dan.
Thanks.
All right. Well, now let's return to the pancreatitis article. We'll discuss management, followed by some risk stratification scoring systems, and we'll finish things up by talking about disposition. So let's start out with management.
Okay.
So now you've made a diagnosis, or you're pretty strongly suspicious for this diagnosis. What do you normally do?
Well, I think the first thing is always going to be pain control. Your patient is in pain. You want to treat their pain. But before we talk about pain control, I actually want to talk about fluids. We've all been taught that one of the important things in pancreatitis is giving our patient tons and tons of fluids and flooding them. This article actually suggests that that may not be the ideal situation. So they looked at a few studies, and they actually found that moderate volume of fluids is found to have less complications.
As opposed to heavy fluids.
So the data that they found shows that there is less risk of patients being put on a vent, developing abdominal compartment syndrome, sepsis, and even, I believe, better mortality benefits in patients who receive moderate volume fluids.
All right, so too much fluids can increase the risk of respiratory failure, abdominal compartment syndrome, sepsis, and mortality.
Yeah. One of the studies that they discussed is a cohort study from 2011. And what they found is that patients who received less than 3.1 liters of fluid in the first 24 hours that was not associated with a poor prognosis.
Hmm.
But if they received more than 4.1 liters, that was associated with development of persistent organ failure compared to that smaller volume.
I was just about to ask you, well, what is too much and what is judicious? And it sounds like, say, a standard-sized adult, somewhere between 3 to 4 liters is kind of your borderline.
Well, they kind of used 3.1 and 4.1. They didn't really talk about that in between.
Not 4.2, but
exactly.
4.1.
4,100, exactly.
Right, all right. So try to go...
And actually, another study actually said that there's increased risk of complications in 4.3. So I would use 4 as my cutoff, personally.
Okay.
And I would even try to lean towards the 3 and kind of just reevaluating the patient. We may not see the complications in the ED, but things like abdominal compartment syndrome, ARDS, you know, sequelae of volume overload are a consideration through that hospital course.
Sure. And those numbers, the 3.1 and 4.1 and 4.3 liters, that's all in the first 24 hours.
Yes.
So if, you know, maybe we're not going to give 4 liters in the emergency department, but if you're giving too much in the emergency department and it just continues upstairs, that's a problem.
Yeah.
So we really need to be judicious in that first couple of hours in the ED.
And I think it's important to communicate with your admitting physician as well to let them know what exactly has been ordered and given.
Sure.
And actually that term judicious is exactly what the American Gastroenterological Association has recommended. Judicious use of fluids.
Okay. All right. So, well, it's nice to put numbers because whenever people say that, you know, judicious, which I just said myself, but it's such
what does it mean?
What does it mean, right? So it's nice to have numbers here. It's probably best to avoid more than 4 liters in the first 24 hours.
Mm-hmm.
So be careful in the emergency department that you're not heading them into that tract. All right. We've got pain control. We've got judicious use of IV fluids.
Well, let's, one more point I want to make about fluids is what sort of fluids to use.
All right.
So one point that they make here is that normal saline can cause a hyperchloremic metabolic acidosis.
Mm.
And that acidosis or that acidemia can actually trigger our good old friend trypsinogen. So it can actually kind of perpetuate the cycle. So one paper that they discuss in this article actually recommends lactated ringers as an alternative.
So the balanced fluids. It sounds like Mike Winter's sitting on our shoulder talking about balanced fluids and staying away from normal saline,
mm-hmm.
which is He often refers to that as abnormal saline. This is hyperchloremic.
They do not recommend colloid solutions.
Okay.
You know, if obviously if your crit is low or your albumin needs to be replaced, you need to do that, but not as the first line treatment.
Okay. Treatment, what else?
So let's talk about pain control a little bit here. There are a few different categories, shall we say, of pain medication that we can use. One thing that this paper recommends is actually starting with IV Tylenol.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, I think it depends on your practice environment as well. I know in my training, IV Tylenol was not an option for us. Some places that may be an option, and I know there are definitely studies out there that show that IV Tylenol is non-inferior to opioids for pain control. I don't know that I've ever practiced somewhere that that is available as a first line, but again, depending on your practice environment, that may be something.
Yeah, we have it here at university, but I can't remember ever giving it. My understanding is that it's fairly expensive, I guess.
I don't think that's true. I have read about it. I don't think it's expensive, but I know a lot of places it's kept as a perioperative or postoperative medication as the mainstay. But anyway, something that can be considered. And one point that I want to make is the reason that we do IV, at least initially as a recommendation, remember that they have that pain with eating. So we want to keep them NPO if they're having this severe pain, at least initially until we get their pain under control. And one more point with the IV Tylenol is that it is shown to be equivalent to IV Tramadol. Again, a medication that I didn't ever think to use, IV Tramadol, but maybe something in your arsenal, depending on where you are.
Okay.
One study that they discuss actually suggests ketamine as a next line medication at pain control doses, of course, not sedation doses, maybe a good option for those of you who have this available. And of course, IV opioids if needed. They seem to be discouraging the use. And by that, I mean, in this article, they kind of just have a one line sentence saying, if non-opioids fail to provide relief, then you can use opioids.
Right.
And I think that depends on your practice pattern. Of course, opioid crisis is always a consideration, but sometimes pain needs to be controlled. That's my opinion on
right.
the situation.
Right, sure, absolutely. Anything about NSAIDs?
Actually, they did not mention NSAIDs in this article. And I wonder if that is because of the differential that you'd be thinking about with that upper abdominal pain, gastritis, and things like that. I wonder if people just avoid NSAIDs in general. I know I do when I'm thinking about those upper abdominals.
Sure.
One, actually, when I was researching and preparing, this is an interesting thing that we don't really need to get into, but there was one study out there that actually suggested buprenorphine as a method of pain control. And the reason for that is that it doesn't contract the sphincter of Oddi. So it doesn't kind of exacerbate that pain. So I thought that was interesting. And, you know, there's definitely some research to be done there, but a consideration. This is while your patient is in the ER. Another consideration is, of course, PO medications. If you think your patient is likely to be discharged, if their pain is well controlled, they actually recommend PO acetaminophen or PO opioids before your patient is discharged. And that serves, number one, I think, as a PO challenge of sorts.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Of course, with fluids. And number two, is their pain controlled with that? So I think once you have kind of an idea of the severity and how well their pain is managed, transitioning your medications.
One of the other traditional things that at least I learned in residency was that they need bowel rest, so don't give them oral stuff. But they also talked a lot about placing an NG tube in pretty much every patient with pancreatitis. And we've largely gotten away from NG tubes as much as possible for a lot of things. Where do we stand with regards to NG tubes in patients with pancreatitis?
So this article didn't really discuss NG tubes specifically, but I did look into this a little bit. This is a twofold discussion. First, do you feed your patient or do you not feed your patient? So the data actually shows that feeding the patient, or rather enteral feeds, early in the course of disease can decrease the rates of complication and infection. And I think we already know this from ICU literature that feeding patients generally early is beneficial in most conditions. So pancreatitis is definitely one of those conditions. The next question of whether to put an NG tube and feed them enterically versus TPN or those kinds of things in critically ill patients, again, enteral feeds are shown to have decreased rates of infection compared to parenteral nutrition. But we know that NG tubes come with their own complications and risks. I personally have never placed an NG tube for an acute pancreatitis patient. This may be, again, the training has changed or Well, actually, I think that's what it is. I actually had to look this up because I had never heard of NG tube for pancreatitis.
Oh, that's interesting.
Until, you know, preparing for this.
I'm guessing at least a bunch of listeners out there trained when I did or before. And when I was in training in the early to mid 90s, I think NG tubes were being discussed as kind of maybe we don't need to do this any longer because it was kind of routine.
Sure.
So I'm glad to see that we've really largely gotten so away from it that it's just not a routine part of training now.
Yeah. And one article that I did find suggests NG tube only in the case of paralytic ileus.
That makes sense.
And they say that it may prolong the nausea.
Right.
But again, these are your patients that are likely going to the ICU level of care.
Yeah.
I don't think this is something that we need to be initiating in the ED because again, if food in their stomach is triggering the pain and their pain is bad enough that we need to admit them, let's get their pain under control, get the fluids in them before we start trying.
Okay, so we're going to avoid the NG tube unless it's absolutely necessary. What else?
Yeah, and I can't think of a case offhand where I think it would be.
Sure.
Now, talking about those patients who are going to go home, I briefly mentioned PO challenging them with pain medication. This article actually recommends making sure that they can tolerate liquids at the very least before they can go home because they do need to hydrate and they need to be able to tolerate those liquids. So if you're thinking about sending your patients home, you may not need to feed them solids, but make sure that they can keep something down in their stomach.
Sure.
What did you learn about antibiotics in pancreatitis back few years ago when you were training?
Not much. I mean, there wasn't a whole lot of discussion. Some people would, some people wouldn't.
Okay.
Yeah, what do you say?
My practice pattern and the way that I was trained is that there is no reason to start antibiotics in the uncomplicated pancreatitis patient. This is not an infection of the pancreas. It is inflammation of the pancreas. Mm-hmm. So no reason to give them unnecessary medication.
Sure. That makes
now,
sense.
Again, this is for uncomplicated pancreatitis. Mm-hmm. If you have a co-infection, you have cholangitis or something like that, definitely we need to treat the coexisting infection.
Sure.
And in these patients who look very ill, the toxic patient who maybe has altered mental status looks septic, and then you happen to find that they have pancreatitis in the course of their workup, I think this is definitely a patient where you should be initiating antibiotics until infected pancreatic necrosis or other sources of infection have been excluded.
Okay. Sounds good.
So that's what I would say regarding that.
All right. Next up, the paper talks about some risk stratification ideas, including some scoring systems. You know, we've all learned the Ranson's criteria that we would all get tortured on back when we were all medical students. Is there any utility to any of these things?
Well, I think the Ranson's score is where we had talked about the LDH before. I think that's the only place where I've seen it come into play, at least in our emergency department management. So the answer to that question of is there any utility to these things is, I think it depends. Mm-hmm. To us in the emergency room, it may not have much significance, but these are really hospital and ICU-based stratification scores to help predict mortality outcomes. Now, our job is sick or not sick. Are we going to admit the patient? So let's talk about these different scoring criteria. So Ranson's, as you mentioned, is something we were all taught. It was actually developed back in the 70s in 1974. And I'm not going to go through the different criteria. We can always go back and look at that. But long story short,
I'm sure all the listeners know all 11 by heart anyways.
Yeah. Both ER and ICU.
Yes, exactly.
But a score of greater than 2 suggests that the patient should be admitted.
Okay.
So this is shown to have a sensitivity of 90% and specificity of 67% if you have both the initial and 48-hour in predicting mortality.
Okay.
The next scoring criteria that they talk about here is the Apache 2 score, which I don't believe that this is specific to pancreatitis. I think that this is a ICU mortality score predictor.
Yeah.
This was developed in the 80s, 1985, found to have a 89% sensitivity and specificity of 69% in predicting mortality. So again, you can see with neither of these, the specificity is great. The problem with this Apache score is there's tons of variables. You need a scoring calculator probably online these days in order to come up with your score. Now, there is one set of scoring criteria that is relatively new, developed in 2008, called the BICEPS score.
The biceps? Biceps.
Maybe it's bicep. We could make it sound like that to make it sound exciting. But it stands for Bedside Index of Severity in Acute Pancreatitis. Now, this one has a sensitivity of 76%, so not as good, but the specificity is 87% here in predicting mortality. Now, this one is 5, I believe, scoring criteria, all of which are yes or no, and only has one lab value, your BUN, which you're likely going to be getting anyways.
Okay.
And if you have 2 or more positive, then the mortality rate is 2%, essentially.
2%, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so if you have a score of 2 or more, the mortality is 2%. And I'm assuming the higher the score is, the higher mortality. So ideally, you're hoping for a score of less than 2.
Yeah, those would be the patients that may not need ICU care.
So
the more points, the sicker the patient, essentially.
Okay.
These are all inpatient scoring criteria, as I mentioned, may or may not be the best for us to use in the ED. There's actually been not much data about how these scores in the ED can be used.
Sure.
But one article that they discuss actually talks about things that we've already really mentioned as things that we can use in our ED to help dispo the patient. Vital signs, abnormalities, SIRS criteria, age, comorbidities. The study actually showed that nearly all the patients who developed persistent organ failure and necrosis, needed to be admitted to the ICU or had mortality, they all had at least 2 SIRS criteria when they were admitted, or at least on the first day of hospitalization.
Okay.
So as we always learn, never ignore abnormal vitals.
Sure, yeah. So SIRS, if you're using SIRS criteria and they've already got 2 SIRS criteria, that's kind of a bad prognostic sign from the ED.
Definitely.
So that's something that can be used in the ED. I guess we really need a heart score for the pancreas, but it'll have to be called a pancreas score.
That's a lot of variables.
Yeah. So pay attention to vitals. How often have we heard that before?
Yep.
All right, good. Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about disposition. And there's various levels of disposition. You know, at the one end, we've got a person with mild pancreatitis, and they clearly are going to go home. They're already asking for the turkey sandwich. And then at the
world-class turkey sandwich.
Right, exactly. And then at the other end of the spectrum, we've got the really sick person who's clearly going to be admitted.
Sure.
We've got intractable pain, intractable vomiting. And then there's that middle zone where, you know, you're not really sure yet. And also somewhere in the middle zone, when do you decide to get a consult?
Okay.
So can you address those?
Sure.
Those issues?
So first let's talk about the patient who goes home.
All right.
The patients who are dischargeable need to have a couple of things. Number one, as we mentioned, they need to be able to tolerate PO and at the very least fluids. They should not have persistent pain. Their pain needs to be controlled and no significant GI symptoms. And the symptoms that the article refers to are specifically nausea, vomiting, and diarrhea.
Okay.
Now, I don't have an answer for how you determine whether it's significant or not. Mm-hmm. But I think with all patients that are discharged, with this in particular, return precautions are important. So making sure, hey, if your symptoms get worse, if you can't keep food or fluids down, make sure you come back, because as we've discussed here, there is a high mortality rate in these patients.
Sure.
So definitely not something we want to blow off.
Okay.
So that's the patient that goes home. Who are we going to admit? Well, as we just mentioned, patients with abnormal vital signs should be admitted. Patients who can't tolerate PO, who have intractable pain, or their pain is not well controlled, if they continue to have those severe GI symptoms, the nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and older patients or patients with comorbidities are also shown to have poorer outcomes.
Okay.
Now, the ICU level, I think we kind of talked about some of the things that are going to put our patient in the ICU, but there's a couple of different situations where we want to get consultants involved early as well.
Okay.
And these may be patients who are good for the floor. It may be an ICU patient, but either way, the sooner you get the consult, the better. So first, let's talk about gallstone pancreatitis. Again, this is something we would most likely diagnose with our right upper quadrant ultrasound, is the gallstones itself. And definitely something where you want to get surgery involved earlier. Studies have shown that early cholecystectomy actually has improved outcomes in these patients.
In the gallstone pancreatitis.
Correct, okay. Yeah. Now, there are some cases where you would want to have GI involved. If you have cholangitis or a CBD stone, that patient may need ERCP or MRCP depending on the case, so you want to make sure that GI is involved earlier in those patients.
Okay.
And definitely if you have a infected pancreatic necrosis, those severely sick patients, those ones that are going to ICU, make sure they're getting their antibiotics, and you may want to get surgery involved early for source control on these patients as
All
well.
Right.
Our consultants that we would consider are going to be critical care if that is the MO in your hospital, GI surgery. And then in those patients who come in with alcohol abuse as their trigger, maybe some sort of substance use consult, if that is a resource that's available
sure.
to you and the patient's interested in it.
All right, Neerja, this was a fantastic discussion. I definitely learned a few new things about what I thought is just a run-of-the-mill disease that there's nothing left to learn about. So Thanks. Can you leave us all with, how about your top three take-home pearls for all of us listeners?
Sure. One thing that is interesting and maybe different from the way people are practicing now is that judicious use of fluids.
Okay.
I think that's definitely important.
All right. So judicious IV fluids, and again, 4 liters. You don't want to exceed 4 liters in that first 24 hours.
Yeah, at least based on the data that we have right now.
Okay. What else?
I think another important thing is having a high index of suspicion for not just pancreatitis, but when you're evaluating your patient, making sure you're getting a good history and physical exam. That's really going to help point you to the diagnosis and help you figure out what, if any, imaging is indicated in your patient.
Okay, great.
And I think the last thing, which I've mentioned this several times, before you dispo your patient, make sure you review their labs, review their vitals. If it's somebody you're planning to send home, make sure that they can tolerate PO and that their pain is controlled. This is, again, a disease with high mortality, and we want to make sure we dispo the patient appropriately, both to either admission or discharge and to the level of care.
Good. All right. Fantastic. Well, again, thanks so much, Neerja, for taking us through this article. We look forward to hearing you back on the EMCast very soon.
Thank you.
All right. Well, it's about that time for our summary. We'll kick things off with the discussion of refusal of care. Please remember that about 1-3% of all ED visits result in a discharge against medical advice. That's about 500,000 visits nationally. We all encounter this on a regular basis. Some of our emergency departments encounter this more often than others. It's also important to remember that patients that sign out against medical advice are not necessarily less sick. Studies have consistently shown that patients oftentimes are fairly sick and have a relatively high rate of bounce back and admission when they initially are discharged against medical advice. So we probably ought to make some really good efforts to try to convince patients to stay when we have any concerns at all. In terms of the against medical advice and refusal of care, it's incumbent on us to try to assess the patient's capacity to understand. Again, don't confuse the terms capacity with competence. Competence is kind of a legal term generally determined by the court system and the judge, whereas capacity is what we do. We determine whether somebody has the mental capacity to understand what the concerns are, whether they can apply and process the information we're giving, and also they should be able to express their information and express their choice in a rational way. It's not always a smart decision when somebody refuses, but that doesn't mean that they don't have capacity. We talked about some legal elements in terms of who's the decision maker if a patient doesn't have capacity, and it might vary between different states and different jurisdictions, but generally, court order guardians or medical proxies have the highest ranking, I guess, in terms of who should be making the decision or who serves as a surrogate. That's followed by an adult spouse, followed by an adult child, followed by a parent, followed by a sibling, and then at the bottom of the list is probably a close friend. So when at all possible, if there is no court-ordered guardian or medical proxy, try to find the spouse. If you can't, try to find an adult child or parent or sibling, and so on. So also try to figure out who is closest to the patient and knows their beliefs and their wishes. We talked a bit about some of the medical legal considerations. This is a relatively high risk condition in emergency medicine. So we can't revel in the idea of just kicking people out of the emergency department and give each other high fives. I know we want to do that sometimes, but it's probably not a great idea to be too happy when patients leave against medical advice, because from a medical legal standpoint, those are high risk. And also from a medical standpoint, as we discussed, those are oftentimes high risk patients. When you determine that somebody does not have capacity, you should do everything possible to protect that patient from their own self. Try to get them to stay there. If the patient does have capacity, you can use shared decision making. Do everything possible to explain to the patient why they should stay, what can happen if they don't, risks versus benefits. You don't want to try to coerce the patient or promote fear. Just state the facts. Make sure to offer alternative treatments and also offer whatever best treatments that you have. If a patient needs IV antibiotics, but they're refusing to stay, that doesn't mean that you don't treat them. You put them on oral antibiotics and just make sure they understand that although oral antibiotics are not ideal, that's the very least you're going to do. Make sure to offer them follow-up and always tell them that if they change their mind, they can always come back. Make sure they understand that they are welcome to return if they do change their mind. And then we finish the discussion with a little information about the Against Medical Advice form. I think most of us would agree that the most important thing we can do is to document the discussion with the patient and also their capacity, document it well in the chart. Some hospitals have specific policies that you need to sign the AMA form, and there's some debate about whether it gets kind of confrontational or not. I don't think it has to be confrontational, but if your hospital doesn't have a policy and you are documenting well in the chart, it probably is not necessary. But again, if you're documenting well in the chart and have the signed form, it probably adds an extra layer of protection for you. And we'll wrap things up with a review of the pancreatitis discussion. Again, remember, pancreatitis is the number one abdominal GI reason for hospital admission. It's very common, as you know. I like the mnemonic that Merle threw out for etiologies. I get smashed. And for those of you that like mnemonics, what it stands for is idiopathic, gallstones, ethanol, trauma, steroids, mumps, autoimmune, the classic scorpion bite, hyperlipidemia, hyperparathyroidism, hypothermia, ERCP, and drugs. It's kind of a long mnemonic. I think I need a mnemonic just to remember the mnemonic. But anyway, we'll put that in the show notes if you are into mnemonics. Most common cause of pancreatitis, number one is still gallstones. Number two is ethanol. Number three, which is often not really talked about all that much, is scorpion bites. No, I'm just kidding. It's hyperlipidemia is number three. In terms of the differential, please always remember acute coronary syndrome. I got burned by it once, and fortunately the patient ended up being okay, but it was a very embarrassing burn during my first year out of residency. Again, remember, the diaphragm's not a concrete wall. Anything in the belly can produce chest pain, but also anything in the chest can produce abdominal pain. Lower lobe pneumonias, pleural effusions, lower lobe PEs, ACS, those can all present with abdominal pain. So if a patient has a history of pancreatitis and comes in with upper abdominal pain, that doesn't necessarily mean they're back with pancreatitis. You've got to remember the differential there. In terms of the workup, lipase is the test of choice. Usually you're looking for a threefold increase in the lipase level. Amylase, not all that great. And Merle talked about trypsin levels and trypsinogen, and I don't know that we're going to necessarily be getting that. Maybe down the road. The Atlanta criteria is a clinical set of criteria that is helpful for diagnosis. You need two out of the three clinical findings, for example, epigastric abdominal pain, laboratory findings, specifically lipase, and also imaging. You need two out of those three to meet the diagnosis if you're using the Atlanta criteria. In terms of imaging, CT too early can result in false negatives, so don't feel obligated to get a CAT scan on every one of these patients, especially early. It's oftentimes better to wait 48 to 72 hours. Of course, you're going to get a CAT scan if there's uncertainty in the diagnosis. When do you get an ultrasound? Get an ultrasound if you're worried about the gallbladder, if there's right upper quadrant pain, or if there's signs or symptoms of ascending cholangitis. And overall, MR is superior to CAT scan and ultrasound, but it's still not something that you should routinely be doing unless there are complications or real uncertainty in the diagnosis. Moving on to treatment, crystalloid fluids are very important, but don't go crazy with this. Judicious, not overzealous use of IV fluids. And according to the studies that the paper and Merle talked about, somewhere between 3 to 4 liters in the first 24 hours is ideal. So we should not be flooding these patients in the emergency department. If you do, you're at risk for a higher chances of mechanical ventilation, higher likelihood of sepsis, higher chance of abdominal compartment syndrome, and a slight bump in mortality when you give too much fluids. So try to keep it under 4 liters during the first 24 hours and discuss that issue with the people upstairs as well. Analgesia is important. Early enteral feeding, whenever possible, has been shown to hasten resolution of symptoms. NG tubes are out. For those of you that trained in the early 90s with me or before that, NG tubes was a mainstay of therapy. It's gone. You don't need to put NG tubes in routine pancreatitis. Antibiotics are not necessary in the routine scenario. What about Ranson's criteria? Well, I don't know that you need to remember that except right before the board exam, but if you look it up. If you have a Ranson's criteria greater than 2 at arrival, that is a very high predictor of badness, and those patients really should be admitted to the hospital. And then we're not going to get into Apache or the BISAP scores. You can look that up. ED indicators for admission. Look for vital sign abnormalities. Look for SIRS criteria. And also, if there's any concerns on the exam, I don't need to tell you what the concerns are. When do you get the consultant? Get the consultant if there's a complication of pancreatitis, for example, ascending cholangitis resulting in or related to the pancreatitis, or if you're worried about hemorrhagic pancreatitis and so on, and also if you're worried about gallstone pancreatitis. And those are the key things to remember about pancreatitis. So my thanks to Merle for going through this very dense article, and also my thanks to Dan Gingold for getting us through a very important article on refusal of care. Hope these pearls have been helpful. We've got some great topics for you coming up in May. Until then, hope everybody enjoys the beginning of spring. And if you're in the Southern Hemisphere, I guess that's the beginning of fall. So everyone out there, take care, stay warm, and I will talk to you next month. Bye for now.
Hey, thanks for listening to MCAST. And for listening to the end, here's a discount code for you. Use discount code PODCAST for 10% off each year of an annual subscription to emedhome.com.